Today is July 29th, 2008. My name is Garrett Blavatt, and today I will be interviewing Mr. Thomas Shea about some of his military experiences. Mr. Shea served aboard the USS Housatonic and the USS Tallinn during World War II. To begin with, Mr. Shea, I'd like to start by talking a little bit about your background. Where and when were you born?
I was born in Norwalk, Connecticut, February 19th, 1924.
And did you spend most of your childhood in Connecticut?
No, my mother and father were divorced. He was a World War I vet and he had been gassed. He was with the 11th Engineers, came back, and it was just impossible. Mm-hmm. My mother got beat up a couple times, and so she finally divorced him, and then we moved to New York City.
Okay.
66 West 53rd Street. I still remember the address. Yeah.
What part of New York is that?
It's in Manhattan, and it's, well, three blocks from Radio City on 6th Avenue.
So right in the heart of New York City.
Yeah, I went to elementary school on 125 West 54th Street. It was PS 69.
Okay.
Yeah.
And growing up, what did your parents, what occupation was your mom? What did she do?
She worked for... was Petroleum Heat and Power, an oil company that was a subdivision of Esso, Indiana.
Okay.
And she was in charge of accounts receivable. Mm-hmm. She worked in 511 Fifth Avenue, which was like 43rd Street and Fifth Avenue.
Okay.
So.
And you went to school in New York City?
Well, elementary school.
Okay.
And then in 1938, she rented a house out in Queens County. It was called Hollis, Long Island. And I graduated in 39 and then went to high school in Queens.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what type of activities were you interested in as you were growing up?
When I was 15, I had one goal in life, and that was to get on the New York State Police.
Okay.
And I had read everything you could imagine about the New York State Police. The first superintendent was Major Warner. I used to ride 5 miles on my bike out to Southern State Parkway, where the state police had a substation. And I got talking to them, and eventually they let me go into their library and take books out just on my signature, you know, which...
Mm-hmm.
So I always remember one day, this lieutenant came in and he introduced himself and he said, what do you know about the state police? I said, well, I know a law is a rule adopted by competent authority regulating or prohibiting conduct. And how many types of murder? Three types of murder? He said, holy catfish. He called two troopers in. They said, hey, if you knew a half of what this kid knows, I'd be satisfied.
So did you ever join the New York State Police?
Well, see, I went into the Navy, and
okay.
We had 30 months at sea duty, and we went through three invasions amongst other mm-hmm. trips. And when I came back, I was just, the New York State Police, at that time, you had to live in a barracks for the first 2 years, and you got one night off a week and one day off every other week. So it was, you might say, highly military, you know.
You had enough military experience.
And I had enough of it. I just, yeah. And that was, it's too bad because I've thought about it afterwards and I thought, well, you know, I probably would have done real well on the state police, you know.
But, so other activities when you were growing up, did you like the outdoors? Was that something that interested you? Did you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you go camping in the areas or?
Yeah, you better believe.
Okay, and did you have any interest in sailing or on ships or anything like that?
Not really. I spoke to this lieutenant in the New York State Police. We got to be real friendly, even mm-hmm. though I was there, well, until I was 18. And I asked him, I said, hey, Lieutenant, what would be the best road to go to get on the state police? He said, join the Marines, and it was World War II then, and he said that would be an excellent training program for the state police. So I came home and told my mother, and because my father had been in Europe during all the invasions there, she said, "No way, you're not going in the Marines." So every night I would plot an argument. Now, I would just wait until I could start another argument, and hoping that she would say, "Well, all right, go join the Marines." And she didn't relent.
Okay.
Finally, she said, "Well, if you join the Navy, I'll consent to that." So that's, I ended up joining the Navy.
And how old were you when you joined the Navy?
18.
18, so yeah. you just finished high school then?
Oh, or? Yeah. Well, technically, I had finished all the Regents exams. In New York, you took Regents from the state. So I had passed everything, all the Regents. And I was like, maybe 3 weeks or a month prior to graduation. But because I went in the service, they just gave me my diploma. But yeah, that was.
And so you joined in this May or early part of the year?
I joined in the, it was December of 42.
Okay.
And it was about maybe December 20th. So they, when I went through all the physicals, and they said, "Well, hey, it's too near Christmas. Go home and we'll call you in early January." So January 6th, they called me.
And what was boot camp like for the Navy? Or what happened when you first, they called you back? Where did you go first? And then what did you?
I left for Sampson Naval Training Station up in Geneva, New York on, I can't even think of one of the Finger Lakes it was on, Lake Seneca. And it was dead winter. I mean, it was, that's the first time it was so cold that winter of 43, they said it went down to 42 below one night.
Wow.
I mean, it was bitter, bitter cold, you know?
And so is that where you did boot camp in?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, we talk about February 19th, I was brought to the Naval Hospital with pneumonia on February 19th. So they said, "Well, you know, if you don't get back to your unit by, say, like next Monday, you're going to have to recycle and start boot camp all over again." Well, I really wasn't that well, but because of that threat, I said, "Oh, I'm fine," you know. So I got back to my unit and then finished that up. And
how long did Navy boot camp last for you? Do you remember around
how
many weeks?
I might be off a week. I think it was like maybe 10 weeks.
Okay. And what types of things would they be teaching you? Is it just marching and drill, or were they doing any of the stuff that you would learn on the ship?
Was, you know, swimming, you had to be a certified swimmer before you could get any liberty. It was primarily just a military life. You know, like you say, you go to the mess hall and you had to fall out and march to the mess hall and march back. And then they said that I got my 7 day leave, and they said, "We're going to send you to a quartermaster school in Newport, Rhode Island." So quartermaster in the Navy is navigation. We're in the Army, it's like issuing clothing and supply and what have you. So I finished that and then was transferred in August to the USS Housatonic.
Okay.
But
what was your initial impression of the Navy? How did you find the transition from life?
Oh, I thought the Navy was fine. I mean, we were well trained. That's why I'm so shocked when I hear stories like the last 5 or 6 years where they're saying, "Well, someone, they weren't trained that well," and that, because in World War II, the United States Navy trained us until, you know.
And then, I guess, going to the USS Housatonic, when you arrived there, did you have any thoughts on the ship initially? I know you mentioned before the interview that the guns that it had were extremely old.
Yeah, well, I went aboard the Housatonic, which was a Navy tanker, and that my mother really shuddered when she found out I was on a Navy tanker, because the German subs, that's what they wanted, was tankers. You know, if they could cut the fuel supply down to zero, they knew they would win the war, you know. Mm-hmm. But we went to Africa 7 times, and we'd always come back to Hamilton, Bermuda, and spend 3 days training new destroyer crews or destroyer escort crews. And I never knew why we did this. And here it was, I was in Lake City. I was a volunteer in the VA hospital, and one of the guys that I had sailed with, I met him, and he said, "Hey, do you know why we always stopped at Hamilton, Bermuda to do this? Our captain volunteered for that." I said, "No, just for the experience, I guess." He said, "No, the captain's sister lived in Hamilton."
So, what was it like going over to, what was the role of the tanker in
the
group?
Well, we were assigned to a destroyer squadron.
Okay.
And every third day, we used to call it topping off. Even though they didn't require the fuel, we would pump maximum fuel up so that they were topped off. Mm-hmm. And every third day we did this, because if they had a break and make a run for it, they always had enough fuel, you know? Mm-hmm.
And how many destroyers would be around you? How many boats would there be, or ships would there be?
They always put us in what they call coffin corner.
Okay.
And there was probably maybe 8 okay. destroyers. When we first went to sea, I always remember this, because when I went past the post office, they had a billboard out front, and it was Uncle Sam, and he said, "I want you in the Navy." And they had a picture of a 2,100 ton, the latest destroyer with dual mounts. And I looked at that and said, "Oh, what a beautiful ship." We first went to sea, we had 2 Coast Guard cutters, the USS Ingham and the USS Bibb. And if you can imagine going with a full convoy to Africa with 2, you know, Coast Guard cutters, mm-hmm. which were brought down from Alaska, just shows you, there's another example of how we were not well off at that time, you know.
But it was just the equipment. The personnel were well trained. It was just
caught up. No, yet. I'm just talking about the equipment.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as 43 progressed, were you seeing more and more, were more new destroyers coming into service?
Yeah, and then the advent of the destroyer escort, which was really a light, you know, they called destroyers tin cans for one reason. You know, their skin was about this thick. Mm-hmm. You know, they were literally a tin can, you know. And then they came out with a destroyer escort, which was even lighter, you know, but they probably could build them faster, and you know.
And your role on the ship was, what were you doing?
Well, see, that's another thing. I was a striker for a quartermaster.
Okay.
And they had 5 strikers, and I kept saying to myself, there's no way I'll ever get a rate with 4 strikers ahead of me. So I met one guy, he was a chief petty officer, he was a yeoman, and he said, "Boy, I sure, when we get back to the States, I'm going to put in for another yeoman." So I said, "No kidding." I said, "What's the chances of getting a rate?" He said, "Well, if you can type 60 words a minute, I'll give you a third class." Mm-hmm. So every day I would go in after my lunch and I would practice, you know. So then I went in and took the test, passed it, and he gave me third class. So it was partly money, because my grandmother had Parkinson's disease and my mother was working her backside off, mm-hmm. and I was sending all of my money home, you know. Until the radar picked up a blip, and we went to investigate it, and it was about a 60-foot lifeboat. And this really impressed me as a young kid. Mm-hmm. There was a Bible opened up and all personal belongings on this lifeboat, but no bodies, you know. Obviously, it had been people in it. So they put the oar up, load the gun, and blow it to pieces. So I was a loader, and the trainer and the gun captain wound the gun around and blew it out of the water, you know. And that really did impress me. I said, see, you know, there's a time when hey, you could leave this earth, you know. So then we went to, we would always stop at Casablanca because they were building an oil farm for the invasion of Italy. So we would take our estimated 50% of our load and pump it into the fuel depot in Casablanca.
So you were not only just refueling the ships, you were also providing fuel to the military there.
Right,
okay.
Right. Some of the places I remember were Rabat, Oran, Fidala, Gibraltar. Like I said, we made 7 trips there. One time we were coming through the Straits of Gibraltar, and we had gone down to the Gold Coast of Africa by ourselves with no escort. We rendezvoused with the USS, I think it was the Ranger, and we were talking. When you refuel, usually you shoot the breeze at the other crew because you're mm-hmm. almost lashed side by side. They said, what we do now, I said, have you seen any subs? He said, yeah, we got 2 of them last week. The Germans got kind of cocky and they used to surface and the guys would go out and sun themselves on the deck. Mm-hmm. And they would wait for a blip, a ship coming through Gibraltar Straits, and then they would go after it. So these guys on the carrier, they would fly with their propeller almost touching the water, and they would overtake these subs before they even realized what happened.
Okay. Do you want me to get a glass of water? Or?
Well, maybe I can. So they sunk 2 German subs at that time. Mm-hmm. We went through to Iran, and on our way back, we were going, the tug used to, across the straits, you can believe this or not, they had steel nets so that no submarine could sneak so in.
They were anti-U-boat.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they'd have like 2 tugboats, and they'd open up the gate, so to speak, and then the ship would come in or go out, whatever the case might be. So we were just going through the nets when we blew our main turbine.
Okay.
And so they radioed the English, and they sent 2 additional tugs out and towed us into Gibraltar, the British Navy Yard there, and we were there for 30 days.
Okay.
Getting a temporary patch on her.
Did you have a chance to get out at that time, or did you?
Well, you can only go to Gibraltar, you know, climb the hill, and they had a couple restaurants there. You go in and drink tea in a glass. then we go down and meet the ferry. I think it came over from, I think they said it was Algeciras, Spain. Mm-hmm. And you could buy the fruit. I mean, I was amazed. It's the first time I had seen oranges that were this big.
Wow.
You know, and various fruits. And mm-hmm. Or you'd buy one time we chipped in and bought a whole keg of olives and then busted one out and then ate them like candy. You know? But that was about it. We came back this last time to Norfolk, which was our home port. Normally, we would come back to Norfolk and we'd get orders, and then we would go down to Texas and go to some of the we were refueling. Oh, I'm trying to think of some of the places we went to.
Somewhere down by Galveston, that area? Or?
Well, Galveston once, but we go north up into, I just can't think of the oil refineries we used to go to. But then we would go out and then meet the convoy and go back to Africa. This time we came back and they said, we got orders to give you a transfer. So that's when I went to Newport, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. They had a unit reassigning guys to various ships, and that's when I got reassigned to the USS Talon.
Had you requested that reassignment, or was it just the Navy making that decision?
No, it was like a big hangar, and they had a billboard in front of each yeoman, and it would say, the USS so-and-so, and they tell you the type of ship, and it requires 10 seamen and 15 machinists, and you could put in for it then, So this buddy of mine, he got transferred also. He said, what do you think we're going to go on? I said, we'll just take a ship that's near to New York, so on the weekend we can go home,
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and I happened to pick the USS Talon,
Which wasn't close to New York for very long, was it?
Well, no, not for long. It was launched, and they outfitted it, and then it went down to Charleston, South Carolina, to go through its tryout, Mm-hmm. You go out to sea, and you do all kinds of stuff to see if things worked right. Then we went through went down to Colon, Panama, and stayed there overnight. And then the next day we went through the canal.
Okay.
And that, as I remember, we left about 8 in the morning, and it was about 4:30 in the afternoon when we got to the other side, the Pacific side.
Were there a lot of Navy ships going through the canal at that point?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And see, this, we didn't know it at the time, but this really was the buildup for Iwo,
Okay.
So we went out and...
Well, can I go back a little bit to when you first saw this ship? The Talon was designed as a military ship, so it would have been a lot different from your experience on the Housatonic. It was built differently for a different purpose.
Yeah, well, the Housatonic class was called a T2.
Okay.
And a T2, it gave specification 68 feet wide and whatever it was, 601 feet long. And
mm-hmm.
And we were on this, Talon, it was built to more certain specifications, it was just a different type of ship. It was,
okay.
it was AKA stands for... A is for auxiliary, K is for cargo, and A is attack. So that type of ship was used strictly for invasions.
So you knew when you got on it what that ship was going to be used for?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of. We were assigned to Squadron 16, which was amphibious.
Mm-hmm.
And we carried, as I remember, 22 landing craft. We had these 70-foot LCMs that were modified. An LCM was 60 foot long, but they modified the group going into Iwo, the 70 footers. And they put them on deck and just cradled one on top of the other,
And would you have carried the military personnel, the Army Marines, on at your ship? Or?
Yeah, we went through exhaustive training. I mean, exhaustive. We had a Commodore. There were 6 ships in our squadron. 4 were APAs, personnel. And 2 were AKAs. They carried the equipment, the tanks, the weasels, ammunition trucks, everything that was required. And we had a Commodore, his name was Commodore McGovern. At the time, what I used to call that guy under my breath was, I mean, he would come in, he would come on deck at 2 a.m, you know, and then ream you out because you weren't training hard enough, you know. It was train, day, night. And it didn't take me too long to realize that, boy, that guy sure knew what he was doing. See, a Commodore, when a full captain retired back then, and they called him back, they gave him an honorary rank of Commodore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he really knew what he was doing, you know?
And would you have done any training on the landings? I know I spoke with a gentleman the other day who was saying that they had done training at Maui, I believe, to do practice for the invasion of Iwo Jima.
Yeah, well, see, that's where we went to, okay. Maui. Okay. And the reason, I never knew why we went to Maui until years later, either on TV or someplace I was reading. The reason why they used Maui is because it had the volcanic sand similar to Iwo.
Okay.
Of course, we didn't know this at the time, you know.
And they weren't going to tell you where you were
going. No. Even the captain, they said the captain had no, he would open up his orders after we were at sea for 2 days, 48 hours, he could open up his orders, you know. So we finished training. We went back to Pearl for one day of liberty. And the guy I went to high school, his name was Howard Roberts. I knew he was in the Army Air Corps. And he was in whatever it was, Schofield Barracks or whatever it was. I don't really remember. So when I hit the dock, there was a phone there, and I picked it up and I called and identified myself. And I said, I would like to find out where I could locate Howard Roberts. He says, speaking. You know, that coincidence there. So I said, you know, have you got liberty? He said, yeah, I got one day liberty. He said, well, I'll meet you not Pearl Harbor, but the beach there, one of the restaurants. And so he said, what are you doing? I said, I have no idea. He said, well, you're probably going, now this is the Army, the difference between the Army and the Navy. The Navy tells you nothing. The Army, they'll give you all the description. He said, you're going to one of three islands. I said, what? He said, yeah, you're going to Iwo Jima, Chichi Jima, or Haha Jima. And that means Baby Island, Mama Island, and Papa Island. I said, wow. You know, this is like, you know, something in the Bible coming true, you know. So I went back to the ship and told some of the guys, and we finally decided I better shut up because naval intelligence would find out this, and you know. So that's what we did. We ended up, we went to, I think it was Ulithi, it was the staging area.
Okay.
Where all the ships congregated, and then we went into Iwo Jima.
And what part of the troops were you carrying, or do you remember what Marine Division you were working with?
Yeah, we were with the 5th Marine Division. And the first thing I remember, this Marine, I did not know him prior to this, but he was from the next town that I lived in, Hollis, and he was from St. Albans. So we got to be real friendly. And we had 24 war dogs aboard, 12 cages on one side of the ship and 12 on the other. And they would take one dog out at a time. They were male Doberman pincers. And I love dogs, but those dogs were, they would attack anything, another dog or, you know. So he came to me, this was about 2 or 3 days, we were on our way to Iwo, and he said, Tom, I need you to do me a favor. I said, what is it, Joe? He said, I got a new corn broom, and when I take my dog out on a chain, he said, swat him in the face. I said, what? He said, yeah, beat him with the corn broom. We got to toughen him up. I said, if that chain breaks, I'm going right over the side. <You know? laughs> So we did it. And then to this day, I can still see the dog, a male Doberman. I swear he, when he was on the chain standing like this, he was probably 6 foot tall, you know.
What were those the dogs used for? Did you find out or did you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were strictly attack dogs that were used for night infiltration.
Okay.
The Japs would sneak out at night, and the dog would, it, you know, alert the Marine. So then we got to Iwo, and we were brought right in to right under Mount Suribachi. The code name was Hot Rocks. And any time you referred to a bearing, an airplane, they'd say flight coming in at 090 Hot Rocks. You knew where to look, you know. So we were at the guns were fully loaded. And that time I had transferred to a 20 millimeter. I hated that, the big gun. Mm-hmm. So the gunnery officer said, this was prior to getting D, well, if you train every day on a 20 millimeter, I'll transfer you. So I was put on gun 213. And
What would a 20 millimeter, what would its responsibility be on a ship? What would it be used
for? Strictly anti-aircraft.
Okay.
You know, it was no surface firing at all. It was strictly airplanes. So what had come right over Suribachi, and your vision was limited because Suribachi was 500 feet high, mm-hmm. whatever it was. We're all at the guns, and the whole squadron opened up. It was a Jap plane. We shot it down. There's only one catch. Right on his tail was a Navy plane.
Okay.
And we shot that down too. You know, it's not like a rifle mm-hmm. when you're firing. So then it was gloom and doom. Oh my God, the first thing we do is shoot down in one of our own planes. And mm-hmm. the Commodore said, don't sweat it. The Navy guy, the Navy pilots had strict orders, do not come over the fleet area. And this guy apparently got carried away chasing the Jap. Mm-hmm. And we got him too, you know. So then our sister ship. Oh, and I really should backtrack and go back to Hilo.
Okay.
When we finished Liberty, and then we went to Hilo to load, and we were supposed to load the 5th Marine Division. While we're loading their equipment, the fire alarm went off on our sister ship, the USS Leo, which was across the dock. So part of our fire crew went over there to assist, and they found out that the Japanese sympathizers in Hawaii had taken wooden matches and wrapped them with sandpaper mm-hmm. with a rubber band and stuffed them in everything, equipment, pallets, and just as luck would have it, there was enough rolling to cause a fire.
Okay.
So then we had to unload our stuff, and you know, I forget what our capacity was, but it was, you know, maybe 10,000 tons or, mm-hmm. we had to unload everything.
How long would it have taken you to unload the ship?
Well, it would take us like a day and a half okay. to unload everything. And one of the Marines that were there the other day, at Bob Gachet, mm-hmm. he was in the 5th Marine Division, and he went into Iwo. We carried him into Iwo. I know Bob for probably 15 years. And he said to me one day, this was 10, 15 years ago, he said, I don't understand why we had to wait in the hills so long. I said, well, Bob, you don't understand. We had to unload the whole ship, go over everything to find these, you know, packets of matches and sandpaper, and then reload everything. Mm-hmm. So then we got the Marines aboard. And, you know, some of the things that they talk about, how the Navy hates the Marines and all that, but our commissary steward said, hey, you guys, this was like right around Christmas, New Year's.
Okay.
Said, hey, you guys, I managed to get 22 turkeys and we're going to have a real feast. So then when they found out the 5th Marine Division was coming, they got us everybody together and they said, hey, would you guys consent to giving the turkeys to the Marines? So we gave them and they had a Thanksgiving dinner at, you know, in January or December. And we had bologna sandwiches. But I told that to Bob, I said, you know, you guys don't realize what the Navy guys did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
On the ship, did things go pretty well between them? Did you associate much? I know you said that you met a Marine who was from near your hometown. Did you associate a lot with the Marines and talk?
Oh yeah, no question about it.
Okay.
you know, you'd help them out, or if they needed something and you could access it, you'd give it to them. You know. But that was one thing that really should be brought out was the sabotage. At Aloha, you know. Yeah, on the big island there, we were loading.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen anything about that or read about it, but it was part of the invasion.
And it at least delayed ships 3 days.
Yeah.
At least your ship would have been delayed at least 3 days to fix that.
Yeah. So getting back, then we went into Iwo, and like I say, our sister ship had her. She was the one that got set on fire,
mm-hmm.
the USS Leo. And by golly, if she wasn't on our starboard side and the Japs started shooting mortar down. And my first impression when I was in the gun tub was flying fish. You know, it was choo, choo, choo. And then it dawned on me, that ain't flying fish. But then we started unloading,
mm-hmm.
and there was a vicious storm that came in. The ground swells, believe it or not, were 20 to 30 feet high, and you'd have an LCM. They took all rated men. The bosun was a warrant officer,
mm-hmm.
so you had a guy in the electric winch, and they put me as a trip man. It was a 35-ton boom, and they would lay the bridles in the hook like this, and then I would pull the lanyard, and the bridles would go off, and the vehicle would be free, and the boat would take off. That was the mm-hmm. procedure. But because of this rough weather, the officer, and I had my eye on him like every second, you know, and his code was, he's telling the guy in the winch, down on your top,
mm-hmm.
and then with me, he'd say, but he never did it, you know, because of this, the boat is here, and then 10 seconds later, it's down 10 or 15 or 20 feet, you know. So the first ammunition truck we dropped in the boat, and the 35-ton boom comes up with the bridle on it and the steering wheel from the truck.
Mm.
It had wrapped around and yanked it right out of the GMC. So they said, well, told the coxswain, take it out, start it up, and drive it overboard. So the second one, he said, now we really got to be careful with these swells, you know. Second one, the bridle doesn't get caught on the steering wheel, and it bends it over. But they said, hey, it's drivable. Let it go over to the beach, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to think. All the beach masters were Navy guys.
Okay.
And there was such bedlam, so much equipment had been bogged down. Boats would breach. They'd pull up onto the sand or ash, and then it would go sideways. Once they went sideways, that was the end of it. They couldn't, that was the end of the boat, you know. So,
And the boats, they were being used you wanted to use them again because they needed to take off wounded soldiers after they dropped things off, correct?
So. Well, I would. We didn't do that at first, but the Beachmaster started screaming for medical supplies and landing mat, you know, like they put down for an aircraft to land. Mm-hmm. And where was that? But it was down the bottom of the hole. So here you are again. You talk about Yankee ingenuity, you know? Mm-hmm. Said, oh my God, what are they going to do now? So they took all of the landing craft from our squadron and they took half of them and they would say, they would approach our ship. We would unload everything into these landing craft, get to the medical supplies on the landing mat, put them in the other boats, and then reload the ship again.
Okay.
And they did that with the eight ships. Well, not really, because they were, I shouldn't say that. It was only the cargo ships that they were doing this with. So that was another feat, you know. I'm trying to think. Oh, we watched both flags go up. The first one, then the second one. Every ship in the harbor blew its whistle when the flag went up, you know. So then...
How far off the beaches would your ship have been? Because you wanted to be close to make sure it was a short trip landing craft.
We were in real close. We were they had first, second, and third echelon. We were first echelon. Mm-hmm. So we were real close to Suribachi. I'm trying to think.
And would you have been taking fire from the island or?
Well, not after that first episode with
the plane
and then with the mortar shells, you know. No, we didn't have to worry about that. But we got every night at about 7:30, we would all congregate and they had a pool. At what time is the first raid coming? And, you know, you'd say, okay, I'll take 41, you know, 7:41, and everybody would throw in a quarter into a pot, and, you know, if you won or you didn't win. Oh, another thing that really amazed me, there was an LST. An LST is about, I think it's 210 feet long.
Okay.
And it had tanks welded to its starboard side. And we had Piper Cubs in our hull. So we unloaded them into the boat and he brought it over to this LST. And we heard this and rum, 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 rum. So what is that? Looked. And here the LST had filled up these tanks with water. So it had a list on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had its boom over there with the Piper Cub hanging about 6 feet from the water. And the pilot would rev it up and then they'd pull the hook and the plane would go, nur, 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 and they'd go into Iwo. And that was the only observation they had in the beginning, mm-hmm. you know. So they come back and they just ditched the plane in the water.
Okay.
That was the end of it, you know. I'm trying to think of what.
Reading the information on Iwo Jima for the ship, it said that you suffered slight damage during the attack.
Yeah, but there was one other thing I wanted to mention, and that was there was two hospital ships there. There was the Mercy and the Hope,
mm-hmm.
and they were overboard. I mean, you were looking at several thousand injured, wounded, you know. Mm-hmm. So they took our squadron and they made it like a hospital ward. Maybe Ward 1 would get gut injuries and Ward 2 would get limb injuries.
Mm-hmm.
We got head injuries. Mm-hmm. So all the head injuries came out and they were put on our ship.
What kind of preparation would your ship have? What kind of medical staff would your ship have had?
A few corpsmen and a doctor from upstate New York, Dr. Bly, that we heard later on that he had a complete nervous breakdown, and they had to take his credentials as a doctor away from him. He just
was this because of what he had seen.
Oh, there's no question. No question about that. Yeah, offhand, that's about all I can think of, I guess. We got there on February 19th, and we left, I think it was February 28th. Mm-hmm. So we had our first sandwich was a marine water buffalo. We were backing down, and when you back down, you give like four blasts to your whistle.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently these Marines weren't paying any attention. We were backing down and we sank the water buffalo,
mm-hmm.
which is a large tracked vehicle, you know? And it bent our, well, we call them screws, not the propeller, we call it the screw.
Okay.
And then from the air raids, we had received, they shot all our antennas off, and it was all superficial damage, really, you know? Mm-hmm. Then on February 28th, we got the orders to leave.
And just to get a sense, how many ships would there have been when you were there? If you looked across the water by Iwo Jima, could you even count the number of ships? Or?
Oh, I mean, it was just massive.
Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't know if you told me 600, I believe.
Okay.
That's probably right.
And was there always stuff trying to get through to the beach? Was it just a constant the whole time you were there? Things going in, things coming out?
Yeah. Always activity, you know? And then, like I say, then at night, as soon as 7:30 came, you were aware that the Japs were going to send air raids over. So at night, you had to be on the gun, and it was air raids, you know. They told us we had, out of the 22 or 24 boats we had, they said that any boat you have left, leave them here, so that those guys can utilize them. So we went down to Guadalcanal. They had a boat yard down there. We went down to, we called it Iron Bottom Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked up a new complement of boats. Then from there, we went down all the way below the equator, down to Espiritu Santos in the New Hebrides group,
mm-hmm.
because they had a secret dry dock there.
I think I've heard that a lot of the ships with the carriers I know would have gone there to be fixed.
Oh, yeah.
Up.
And the Japs were thinking that we had to send all the ships back to Seattle or wherever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, they were running them down to New Hebrides, you know.
What was it like there? Just how?
Jungle. Jungle is the best description.
Okay. Was it just a lot of activity in the middle of nowhere? Or?
Yeah. I can remember they said, well, hey, we had an executive officer that was super, super. He said, hey, you know, I'd like to get a beer. And we heard that the Army has a PX down the end of the island, you know. I said, well, if you can get down there, go ahead and do it, you know. So this was after we came out of the dry dock.
Mm-hmm.
And we were loading the New York 27th Infantry Division for the invasion of Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to go into Okinawa with another Marine Division on April 1st, but because we had to go down to the dry dock and get repaired, we picked up the New York 27th and went into Okinawa. We went into Naha,
mm-hmm.
went in on April 9th.
Was there any difference in how people were, the treatment of Army versus Marines on the ship, or how they interacted with the Navy personnel when you picked those?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Hey, you were all part of the team, you know.
And these people were all New York, this was at the New York National Guard, correct?
New York, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was called the New York 27th.
Mm-hmm.
And there again, you got real friendly with the guys, and I met one guy, his name was Timmons, and we got real friendly, and he said, come on down to my truck. So we opened up the hatch and went down into number 3 hold, and his truck and many, many others were there. So he opened up the hood, and here was loaded with beer. So he says, "Hey, I'll give you a case of beer." You know, I said, "Well, God, I gotta stow it someplace. You know, if they find out I got a case of beer, they'll get all shook up." So I stowed it, and then we had, when we get liberty on one of the islands, we had enough beer to last us. You know, but I was, when I got back, and then I'm breaking away again. When I got back, I heard the New York City Fire Department was giving a test for firemen. So I went down to Ozone Park, to one of the high schools down there. And the line was around the high school. And I'm walking down to get to the end of the line, and who's there but Timmons? Mm-hmm. I said, "You got through Okinawa, right?" I said, "Yeah." I used to call him crazy because he had, on his army ammunition truck, he had a big American flag. I said, "I wouldn't advertise that when I was going to shore." You know? But he made it. We went into Naha, and the air raids there made Iwo Jima air raids seem like small time. Mm-hmm. So we finally got our orders to leave, and we went south down around the Karamarettas. And we were quite a way south, and I look up and I get that flash, and I, by God, it's a Japanese plane. I said, "Oh my God, get me out of this and I'll try." So the thing dove at us, mm-hmm. and we kept firing and firing and firing, and he crashed in the water probably about 8 or 10 blocks from us, you know. Mm-hmm. So then we were in on the invasion of Cebu in the Philippines. We went down to Angar in the Philippines. And no, I stand corrected there. It was Angar in the Peleliu's.
Okay.
And we picked up in Cebu. The army had gotten the Japanese up into the hills, but they had no heavy equipment. So we picked up these, we call them long toms. They were cannons. They were like maybe 155 millimeter cannon, mm-hmm. on 12 or 14 rubber tired wheels, you know. We brought them into Cebu. So that was the end of our invasion. Then we went up into the northern part of the Philippines, and we're practicing for the invasion of Japan. Mm-hmm. And I can remember I was in the boat, and we pulled up alongside of an LCI. And this guy hollered down. So the guy says, "Hey, did you guys hear the war is over?" And one of the guys had a a rifle. He said, "You better shut your..." He used Navy terms. "You better shut your mouth, or, you know, or else." Mm-hmm. So come to find out, the guy was right. That was when they were talking about September 2nd. So they took us and brought us around until, I can't think of the port. We picked up another army outfit. And September 1st, the day before the signing of the armistice, we went into Yokohama, okay. with this army unit. And then on September 2nd, we went out into the bay or Tokyo Harbor, and with glasses we could see the signing on the big Mo on the battleship.
Okay.
So then,
What were your initial thoughts when you heard that everything was over? Was there a lot of celebration on the ship afterwards? Oh,
it was almost impossible to believe, because mm-hmm. We had set such a fast pace, you know. Mm-hmm. So then they said, "You've got to go down to French Indochina, parenthesis, it's Vietnam." Yeah. We went up into Haiphong, the northern part of Vietnam, and they put us with the Chinese 52nd Army. That was Chiang Kai-shek's 52nd mm-hmm. Army. And we brought them up into Qinhuangdao, China, mm-hmm. where the Great Wall comes down to the ocean. That was another thing, experience, you know, to see the Great Wall.
Did you get to get off at any point, or was this?
No, I didn't get go up on it, but we were.
You got to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have any communication with these Chinese soldiers when they were on your ship?
Well, that was the problem. They'd always, I knew the baker, and every morning, I would never go down to the mess hall and eat, but he'd give me a fresh loaf of bread. And we had swiped rations from the Marines. We had margarine, cans of margarine,
mm-hmm.
and we'd make toast and put margarine on it and have coffee. And
mm-hmm.
So the Chinese would come over and say, "Dayong, dayong, dayong." Nice to say to my buddy, "God, I don't know what the heck this guy's talking about," you know? Say, "Dayong, dayong." Say, "I'm sorry, buddy, but I don't know what you're talking about."
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple days later, we were sitting out on deck, and the Chinese were all around us, and two Chinamen were talking. It was one of these guys that he used to come to me in the morning and ask for this.
Mm-hmm.
He was speaking French to his buddy.
Mm-hmm.
So I had 2 years of French in high school, and I had enough that I could get ideas across, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parlez-vous français, oui, you
yeah.
know. So, I asked him, you know, pourquoi, doyon, doyon, pourquoi, you know. He said, "Oh, le pain, see, bread."
Okay.
French for le bread. Oh, God. You know, I would have given him half the loaf if I knew what he wanted, you know. So, they left, and... trying to think. I think that must have been around December or November. And then we headed back to the States.
And did the Navy have any kind of point system with who would go, what ships
yeah.
or who would go
and
back?
I had Boku points.
Okay.
But the captain wouldn't release this.
Okay.
He said, "No, you're required to bring the rest of the troops back." And I said, and I had like, you needed like 80 points,
mm-hmm.
and like I had maybe 110 or something like that. So the captain, this is another point I wanted to make at Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
The first class pharmacist mate came up with the list of guys in sick bay, and the captain's name was on it. So I said, "What's wrong with the captain?" He said, "Drunk, you know." So that was that. Always that went over big.
I think we're gonna have to stop this for a second.
Okay. I talk too much, I guess.
No. The tape's too small. We're back.
Yeah, well, we came back to Pier 96, and to go into the Columbia River when the tide changes, it's a awful approach,
mm-hmm.
because all the water in the Columbia River is trying to get into the ocean, and the ocean is pushing back. So there was a ship in front of us, and that made it into the Columbia River. And we made it through and got into the Columbia River. I was standing on the bridge when I saw them run up a red flag. We used to call it a Baker flag. And what it meant was, "I'm out of control." So I quick turned to the officer of the deck and said, "The ship in front is out of control." So we had enough warning to go around them. We went down and we tied up in Pier 96. And about 3 or 4 hours later, here two tugboats bring this ship down and tie it next to us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was up on deck and I said to the guy, "Hey, any guys from New York?" He said, "No, but there's one guy from Connecticut." "What's his name?" "Sturm." It was my cousin.
Okay.
Yeah. This ship was a USS Mount Baker, an ammunition ship.
Okay.
So Sonny Sturm came down and we greeted each other and that. And he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I rate 1 month's leave and I'm going to take the train and go back to New York, you know." Well, he says, "I'm going to hitchhike back. Why don't you come with me and we'll hitchhike back? We'll save the $70 train fare." So
Was the military providing transportation, or was this you had to buy your own ticket to get back?
Oh, no, you had to buy your own ticket, but because you were military, you got a, like maybe a 50% discount or something. You know, it was a very attractive deal. You know? So I said, no, Sonny, I don't want to hitchhike back, you know. So when I got back, I heard, they said, hey, did you hear about the guy on the Mount Baker? He was hitchhiking back to New York, and he got picked up, and the car had a head-on collision. He got killed.
Oh.
So, I mean, that was a shocker, you know? So then...
What was the transition like when you arrived back in New York towards going from military to civilian life? How was that for you?
Well, you were almost... I don't know how to explain it, but I didn't really want to get back into civilian life. I just wanted to be with my buddies, you know? Mm-hmm. You say, well, that's, you know...
But there's also on the other side, you were talking about how you no longer had an interest in the police.
Yeah.
So there was the sense you wanted to be with your buddies, but you wanted to get away from the restrictions of military life.
I know, but see, that came later. Okay. But when you first got back, all you knew was your buddies. Mm-hmm. You know? When you're looking at, I was in almost 4 years,
yeah.
And everything is your buddies, you know. Hey, give me a cigarette. Yeah, here, you know, throw you a pack, or, you know, that's the way it worked. So we would meet every night. They had a 5220 club. That was the name they gave to the veterans. You got $20 a week for 52 weeks. So we used to call it the 5220 club.
Okay.
You go down to whatever government office it was, and they'd write you a check, and then you had enough for them. Well, we'd hang out in this one gin mill and drink beer. So Monday night, maybe it was my turn to throw my $20 check up, and that paid for the group beer for that night. And then the next night it was maybe my buddy Quinn, and maybe it was his turn to throw his check up. So we would drink all week long.
Okay.
And play handball all day long. Mm-hmm. And that was the routine. And I found you just don't go back into civilian life like opening a door and going in. You know, it's got to be a gradual thing.
Mm-hmm.
So a buddy of mine that I had to go into high school with, he said, hey, Ruth Wunsch called and wants you and me to go to a party over at her house. And she's already picked a girl for you. And I'm gonna go with her. You want, no, I don't wanna go at any point. No, no, no. So he kept bugging me and said, okay, all right, I'll go. So we went over there, and that's when I met my wife, you know?
Okay. Oh. So was it an arranged first date? Was it the person you were supposed to go with?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and that was it. Yeah.
And this the 5220, did that sort of gradually phase out over the course of the 52 weeks where it started?
Yeah, we didn't. This was like when I came back, when we got a new gun on that tanker, I was sitting up on the rail, and the guy from the Naval Gun Factory was saying, this gun, you will not believe this gun. This gun can go 360 degrees, and it can go from 0 to 89 degrees like before you could snap a finger. He said, I'll show you. Anyone? And I was sitting up on the handrail, and I went backwards and fell down one deck on my spine.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that was the cause or not, I developed a cyst on my spine.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, when you go to get discharged, just report that. So they originally had assigned me to the Seattle Naval Hospital to be operated on. When I was there, I happened to go out, and a yeoman was putting up a notice, and it said, if you have more than 90 points or something like that, and you need medical attention, you can request any naval hospital in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was within walking distance of St. Albans Naval Hospital.
Okay.
So I put in for it, and blap, they put me on a hospital train, and went right to St. Albans Naval Hospital. where they operated on me, and that was then I'd meet all my buddies at the gin mill, or mm-hmm. you know. So then I met my wife, and that was the end of that. I mean,
and then eventually you end up in Florida shortly thereafter.
I met this woman up on the main drag, this Mrs. Hannon, and I had been a friend of her son, Donald Hannon, and I had heard he was killed in World War II. Mm-hmm. So I met her and I said, "How you doing, Mrs. Hannon?" "Oh," she says, "I'm not doing too bad." She says, "But Pop Hannon is really, he was a CPA and he had a business in 60 Wall Street. It was called Hannon and Lynch, CPAs. And so I went down and I introduced myself, and we got real friendly, and once a week we'd go to a movie and then stop in and have a beer. And mm-hmm. So as time went on, we got more and more friendly, you know. He said, "Tom, if you go to college and take accounting, major in accounting, and become a CPA, I'll give you half of my business on mm-hmm. Wall Street."
Okay.
So I went to Adelphi College and I majored in accounting and minored in business. Mm-hmm. And I was probably 2 years into it. And at night, I'd be up all night long doing problems, you know. The ABC Coal Company shipped 100 carloads of anthracite coal, and when it got to New York, it was 50% egg coal and 40% pea coal, and you had to break all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I said, "What am I doing? And I hate this stuff, you know." So I quit. And then I went to electronics school and then went to work for the telephone company, and that's how I got into communications, you know.
And were you married by the time you went to school, or?
No. Okay. When I went to work for the phone company, I had to start like the beginning of January, and I said, "Well, I'm going to get married in February." They said, "Well, that's all right." So February 19th, I was married.
Okay. Another February 19th.
Yeah, right.
And
then I'm trying to think. Oh, I took a job on the New York State Thruway. When I was with the telephone company, I got into a video and data unit. Mm-hmm. But New York City got to be a hassle. I mean, it was, what night do you want off this week? So it was 7 days a week. What night do you want off this week, you know? Mm-hmm. So I took that for about 6 or 7 years. And I told my wife, "I can't take it anymore." You know? Mm-hmm. So I ended up in Syracuse and went to work for, back in those days, you get a cardboard ticket mm-hmm. when you get on the thruway, and when you got to the other end, the guy would put it in a processor and he'd say, "That's 275 or mm-hmm. whatever. Well, all that information went into a remote recorder, because they were also checking on the collectors to make sure they weren't mm-hmm. pocketing some stuff. And they had 35 millimeter cameras that when the car hit the treadle, it would take pictures. And so I worked that job for, I guess about 5 or 6 years. My wife hated upstate New York. I mean, it was, the year we left, they had 176 inches of snow.
I was thinking Syracuse is right in the snow belt. So.
And I had got a call at about 2 a.m, wanted me to go out to Waterloo, New York, because one of the machines broke down and the truck traffic was, so I tried everything to talk them out of it, you know. They said, "No, you gotta go out." So I went out, and when I got to Weedsport, I pulled in there and it was a blinding snowstorm. Mm-hmm. And when I went past, there was a New York State Trooper's car there, he turned his flashing lights on and he said, "Where are you going now?" I said, "Well, I got to go out to Waterloo." He said, "Well, I got to go out to the barracks and pick up my mail. How long are you going to be?" I said, "It's going to be one of the fastest repairs you have ever done." So he drove me out there, and he came back an hour or so later, and I definitely found that trouble and fixed it. And all I could think of was, oh, we came across Montezuma Swamp, and these troopers, if you should drive 60 miles an hour on snowy, icy road, hey, they'll drive 80, you know? So when he came across Montezuma Swamp, he lost it, and we went into the mall.
Mm-hmm.
And then he called Syracuse and wanted an ETA, and they said, 6 a.m., they'll have a tow truck out mm-hmm. there. But so we had to sit there all night long, well, not all night, but I mean, for an hour or two. And they towed us out, and I got back to Weesport. I got in my car, I got on the radio, and I said, 3263 out of service, Weesport. And right away they said, no, you've got to go to electronics, GE Electronics Park. Exit 37, they've got problems there. So I went there.
Mm-hmm.
I found that trouble and fixed it. And I said, oh my God. All I could think of was getting home and take a hot shower and have bacon and eggs for breakfast or something like that. So I went over and I picked up the Syracuse paper, and I happened to open up to the want ads, the personnel want ads. And here's a picture of a palm tree and the sun behind it. And it said, how would you like to work in sunny Florida? I said, holy catfish, well, that sounds pretty good. So I called the guy up, and it was RCA. They were looking for troops.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me the benefits that, you know, I had to come into the Syracuse Hotel and take an exam.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in, and it was another typical Syracuse night, windy, snowy, cold. And I took the exam, and I had been away from electronics really for so long, you know, working and mm-hmm. also taking electronic tests are two different things, you know. So all these young guys, he had two rooms. In one room, he had all these desks, and these guys would take the test, and they'd give it to this guy, and he'd go into the next room and come out a few minutes later. He'd say, well, I'm very sorry, Mr. Jones, but maybe better luck next time. And I'd look at these young guys. I was 30-some-odd years old then. And I'd look at these young kids, you know, and say, God, they're all flunking. What chances have I got, you know? So I took my test and gave it to him, and I put my coat on. He went into the next room, I put my coat on, put the collar up, went out, hit the button for the elevator, and he came out looking for me. He said, where are you going? I said, you're gonna tell me I failed, right? No, no, you passed with flying colors. So that's how I got the job with RCA.
And this was down, I think you said it was Merritt Island, is that correct?
Well, no, I went to work at the Cape.
Okay.
But I lived on Merritt Island.
Okay.
And then when Kennedy became president, which I think that was 64, I wouldn't swear to it, they transferred me over to Merritt Island.
Okay.
Because whenever a Democrat was in, RCA, which was one of the biggest contributors to the Democratic Party, they would get the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Then when Nixon got in, who would get the contract but AT&T, the biggest contributor to the Republican Party? And this went on and on and on. They'd say, boy, this sure is a political thing. Mm-hmm. No, 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 you're misreading. So I got transferred over to Merritt Island. It was called MILA, Merritt Island Launch Area.
Mm-hmm.
And after Kennedy was murdered, they changed it to Kennedy Space Center.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I retired from.
And what would your job have been there?
Well, my title when I retired was Senior Communications Engineer. We took care of all video, data, and audio, strictly ground communications to the bird. they had an umbilical and the cable was plugged into the side of the bird. Mm-hmm. And all the data on that would come back to the computer. And it was our responsibility until they had first motion. First motion, the bird would kick the umbilical out. And as soon as that cable came out, it went to an RF unit that took over. And our responsibility ceased, you know. So basically, that's what it was. It was just video and data transmission.
So how long were you there? When did you end up retiring?
I went there in 64, and I retired. Oh, God.
Because I was just curious what changes you had seen happen there over the course. I was curious what changes you had seen that had happened there over your course of...
Well, I always remember the accident on, was it 34, where they burned up the three astronauts right in the capsule on the ground. I don't know whether you remember that or not.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. And they had a oxygen environment where they could have used, you know, some other environment, but NASA was in such a rush, you know. And that, I had written a work order to install 7 abort circuits. And the due date was Friday. And when I was home, I laid down on the couch and I was dozing off. My wife woke me up and said, "You hear? They just burned up the three astronauts in 34. I said, the first thing flashed in my mind was these abort circuits, you know. Mm-hmm. They tried to abort and they couldn't abort. And it wasn't that. That was not the problem. But my first initial shock was... So then, well, the next real thing was the Challenger.
And you were still on board?
Well, I hadn't worked. I was senior, and they'd gotten a lot of young engineers in there. And my boss, he and I were very friendly, and I don't mean I was shining up to him for any reason at all. We were just very friendly. He'd say, "Hey, Shay, take care of this," and no complaint. I took it and did it, you know. So I hadn't worked a shot in probably 2 years. Now, a shot, depending on how long it took, sometimes they took 2 months, you know, depending on the hold and what have you. You had to sit at a console, and it was a boring job.
Okay.
So I hadn't worked, and if I said 2 years, I'd probably be right. And for some reason, Frank came to me and he said, "Hey, Shay, you're going to work this launch." Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. And we started in on a Friday, and it was in January, and it was bitter cold. They counted down and then they scrubbed. It was Friday, Saturday. They scrubbed it on a Saturday. So then they changed the tee time, moved it back a couple hours, and we went to work Saturday evening and Sunday, and they scrubbed that. Mm-hmm. And so then we came in Sunday night and they said, "Hey," I was listening to the net from Washington, and it's the guy from Washington was telling the test conductor, "You better get this SB in the air because Reagan is going to make his speech on Tuesday, and he wants to include this in the speech." So they got all panicky, and I can remember looking at all of our equipment, and icicles were...
I've seen pictures of that.
And we should not have gone. But they started counting, and then about, as I remember now, I think maybe about 11 o'clock in the morning, they gave the word to go. And I had a white shirt on. We had to wear a tie and a shirt. Mm-hmm. So I left the console, and I went out the side door to look at it, and it was cold. And I said, "Well, it's too cold. I'm going to go back in and look at it on a monitor." So I turned and went to walk up the steps, and I turned around, and that's when it blew. Mm-hmm. And that was that was a shock of all shocks, you know, because the one thing you got to understand, it when they said teamwork, it was teamwork. Even the janitor felt like he was part of the team, which he was, you know. So it was just a real good, almost like a military experience, you know. And that's about it, I guess.
And when did you eventually leave working for, was this still RCA employed through NASA, or was this?
Well, every time they changed presidency, changed parties, they changed the
company.
Contractor or company, yeah. And the last one was Carter, and we call them Fritz and Grits. Carter was Grits, and Fritz was that other guy who was vice president. Democrats, so RCA came back in and had the contract. So I technically have retired from RCA.
Okay. And then I just wanted to go to some other things with regards to your experience in veterans organizations. Have you been involved in any veterans organizations?
Yeah, I there's an outfit called CBI, China, Burma, and India. And if you served in any one of those countries, you could join it. So I joined that because I had been in China, in Xinhuangdao. And I'd been in, I've been in that for, I don't know, maybe 15 years or something, maybe more. And then they formed another group. It was called the Iwo Trio. And Bob Gachet, like I told you, he was in the 5th Marine Division. I've known him for years. He kept bugging me, "Hey, come on, join us." You know? And so, "You guys are Marines, I'm Navy. That doesn't matter, you know. The thing that matters, did you go into Iwo on February 19th, you know, which he knew I did. So I joined that outfit, and they, in fact, I got a call from Bob last night reminding me that the next meeting is the first Friday of August at McAllister's. So that's about it.
And so you this is more recent. You haven't been involved in veterans organizations for a longer time, or when did you start getting involved in some of these groups?
Did I get involved with that?
When did you start getting involved in the China, Burma, India group? When would that have been?
Take a guess, 15 years ago.
Okay, I was just curious if you had noticed any changes in some of these groups.
No, not really, they're all, the only change I see is when I joined, there was 45, and the last count, there was 9. So that tells you that's the picture on the wall, you know.
Okay.
When I was in, we lived in Lake City before I moved to Gainesville, and I used to volunteer in the VA hospital, and I was a member of the VFW.
Okay. And then my last question is just, I want to ask a question about the memory of World War II. How do you think that people remember World War II? How do you think that's changed? And what do you think people should take from that experience? What should people...
Well, you don't realize how serious it was. The only thing I can say is it kept the Germans off the streets of New York and the Japs off the streets of San Francisco. It was about as simple as that. You don't realize how close we came. You know, if it had been a combined Jap-German effort, I think we would have lost it, you know? At no time did I feel that I was just wasting my time, and I felt that, hey, we're doing something to save the country, you know? And you don't realize how many men, and not many women in World War II, but how many men were in. If you got managed to get home, you saw no young guys at all. It was all older men, you know? And women. So Yeah, they were drafting them up to 45, I think.
Well, those are the questions that I had. Is there anything we haven't mentioned that you'd like to bring up before we conclude the interview, or?
No, just offhand, there are certain memories that I've kind of held to myself, and I hesitate to say it because I came down off the gun and I said I didn't want to go down to the mess hall. I just went down and got a cup of coffee, and I wanted to go up on deck and just sit by myself because we had been there all night long. This was the Z-Well. Mm-hmm. And I'm drinking my coffee by myself. I look down and here's a Marine floating in the water. And there was maybe 100 fish around. He was blowing in half. Mm-hmm. And the fish were eating his mm-hmm. innards. So this chief I knew, he was up on the flying bridge. And I said, "Hey, chief, come on down. I got a guy floating in the water." So he came down. And he said, "Oh my God, that's a black mullet." I just remember him saying that. And so he said, "Go get a boat rod, a boat hook, and go down the net." So I climbed down the net and I managed to get this Marine. He had a shovel and his backpack on, helmet on, and I pulled him over and they threw down a very small net, and I got it around him and they pulled him up. Mm-hmm. But I can still see that guy's face, you know? Yeah, many a night I still see his face, you know? Yeah. There's been a couple instances like that you still, for some reason you get a flashback, you know? It's, and so these people that are all, that's another thing I failed to tell you. Excuse me. Is that when we were in Yokohama, after the signing, they sent us up to Kure, the Navy Yard there, mm-hmm. Naval Base. And the next day they told us, "Okay, we're going to send you guys up by small boat to Hiroshima." Mm-hmm. And if you want to ask me what the most emotional thing I've ever had in my life, it was Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. We went up. I said, "Now, don't eat anything, don't drink anything, and by all means, don't cut yourself." And this was like maybe 6 weeks after they had dropped the bomb, mm-hmm. 7 weeks after. And I got up there. When I got out of the boat, I said, "I don't believe this. You know, that one bomb could do this," mm-hmm. because Hiroshima was built on a fault, mm-hmm. you know, so all the buildings were cement mm-hmm. and steel. It wasn't like there were bamboo shacks, you know. And I can remember going across that one bridge where the guy's shadow was burnt into the concrete. He was on ground zero when the bomb exploded. We went down into the air raid shelters and they were loaded with bodies. They hadn't even gotten that far. They were cremating them in the field. They had two or three units were just cremating bodies. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most emotional letters I ever wrote to my mother was after seeing, and that was a firecracker by today's standards.
Yeah.
And when I hear these people today say, "Well, why don't you nuke them?" You know, I say, "You poor fool, you don't know what you're talking about," you know. Mm-hmm. But forgot to mention that, but that was a very emotional thing.
And definitely, I mean, your comments are about an enemy that you fought against for a number of years, and I guess that's one of the things that strikes me is this is someone who you had every reason to dislike, and seeing that is such a powerful experience to you.
Yeah.
That says a lot.
You just remind me of another thing. Maybe I'll mention that, but this friend of mine, his name was Alexander, when I lived in Cocoa. I had moved from Merritt Island to North Cocoa. And my daughter-in-law kept calling me up saying, you know, Dad, you can go to, I guess this was 95. In 1995, they had the anniversary, the 45th anniversary of Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. He said, if you fly to Tokyo, the government will fly you from Tokyo to Iwo Jima for the, you know, the meeting of the Japanese and the Americans. And this guy, Alexander, called me up and said, hey, why don't you come with me? I said, well, yeah, I'll get around to it. I got to call Jacksonville to make arrangements. And I kept putting it off and putting it off. And I finally called Jacksonville and they said, buddy, you're 2 days late. We closed the books 2 days ago. So that ended that. Mm-hmm. But then Alexander came home and he called me up and he said, hey, let's go out and have a beer. So we went out and he said, Tom, you would not believe this, but the Japanese soldiers that had been there and the Americans were hugging each other and crying, and, mm-hmm. you know. And I had a term, I wouldn't care if I was in church, I call them dirty little Jap. Mm-hmm. After I heard that, I said, why am I hating those people? They were doing what they were told to do, just like I was doing what I was told to mm-hmm. do, you know? So that changed my whole attitude, and war should not be a first option, mm-hmm. you know? I think that's about everything then.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in to talk with us.
Okay.
And I'll stop the taping.
I hope I did a halfway job.
It's a great job, I think.